Welcome to our new series. We're going to be talking about the middle road, I guess Mark called it, between Orthodoxy and Reform, Zacharia Frankel and the Positive Historical School. I think it's something that probably people are not so aware of from the 19th century, and perhaps or perhaps not the forerunner of conservative Judaism. But with that, we'll let Dr. Mark, it's always a pleasure to welcome him and to start a new series. And as I always say, please invite, you know, a friend, maybe hasn't come in, people haven't come in the past. Often people are sort of hesitant to come in the middle of a series. But now that we're starting a new series, we can start again, you know, fresh, and it's a pleasure. And Dr. Shapiro, we look forward to your enlightening all of us. Vakasha.
Thank you. And yes, it is a new series. It's not going to be 23 classes like the last one, but we did speak about the first two generations of Reform, and we spoke about the Orthodox response. So there's another response as well, a response that I guess comes, as the Rabbi Kalman just said, from the middle. Zacharia Frankel, a figure we'll talk about today, is really regarded as the leader of this group. He was the leader. And there is a continuation from this to conservative Judaism in America, although it's a little more complicated, because Frankel himself is more complicated, whether you can place him really with what will become, I mean, is Frankel the same as Solomon Schechter? So we'll talk about that as well. But before we do that, I know it's a new series, but I have a few things. I just want to finish them. I'll put them aside, and then we'll start fresh. Many of the comments, I see it's not even relevant questions anymore, but I just want to do quickly some of the things I promised and things related to last class. The first is, in the last class, I brought up Rav Shlomo Eger, and someone commented, and I didn't protest, I sort of went along with it, that he was influenced by Hasidut. And I wasn't, at the time, I wasn't sure. And I did say it really is mostly said about his grandson, but I subsequently have checked, and my suspicion, which I didn't voice, was correct, that Rav Shlomo Eger really had nothing to do with Hasidut. He was just like his father. It's all the grandson. The grandson becomes a Rebbe, the Lubliner Rebbe, they called him, and he's in the Ishbitz circle. We'll get back to Ishbitz a little bit later today. So that's Rav Leibel Eger. I also raised the question last time. I couldn't remember whether we spoke about Rav Gedalia Tikhtin, and was he an official rabbi in Breslau together with Geiger, or was he sort of unofficial? And I checked, Meyer actually mentions it on page 111. I should have known this, that he actually became an official rabbi. So in Breslau, you had two official rabbis. You had Geiger for the Reform, and you had Tikhtin Gedalia for the Orthodox. And that became the model that was found throughout Germany of one community paying for both an Orthodox and a Reform rabbi. Usually the Reform was the dominant community. And that's going to lead to Hirsch's notion that we can't be in such a community which has both Orthodox and Reform. We need to separate. We will go into, I'm going to do it in the context after we do the classes on the Positive Historical School, Zelman, Baer, Bamberger, and right in the middle, we'll have a number of classes. It might be five classes on this issue of Orthodox separatism and how to deal with Reform in Germany. But it really is part of the life of Bamberger, so I didn't want to separate it. I mentioned the show. Bridget, I think I called it Bridget and Bernie, but it's Bridget Loves Bernie and the Controversy over it. And I looked it up. Believe it or not, Wikipedia has a whole entry on it. And it shows you how things have changed. I'm just reading from Wikipedia for those who listen online. The series was controversial because of the differing faiths of the married characters, something that today, obviously, would be impossible to even imagine that this was, and this is in the early 70s. Some Jewish groups charged that the series mocked the teachings of Judaism. Rabbi Wolf Kelman. Well, Rabbi Kelman was just mentioning his uncle. That's Rabbi Kelman's uncle. Executive Vice President of the Rabbinical Assembly of America called the show, quote, an insult to some of the most sacred values of both the Jewish and Catholic religions. And then it speaks about some of the Orthodox response. But listen to this. A conservative rabbi organized a boycott by advertisers, and Reform rabbis met with CBS staff in secret to have the show canceled. So here you see that there was unity. Maybe the last time we had this unity between Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform, that you can't have a television show that shows an intermarriage. And as I mentioned last class, my father in his book, my father's not with us this class. He just landed in Dubai, believe it or not, on one of the Jewish tours, because Torah in Motion is, at least I don't think we're doing a tour to Dubai. In his book, he contrasts that to in the 80s, the show 30-something, where no one had a word to say about it. And obviously, today, no one had a word to say about it. And Nachum Shmariahu texted me. I was speaking about Zeldin, that Rabbi Gil's student had a tweet where someone said, doesn't it bother you, basically, that he's intermarried? This is like an anti-Orthodox person. And Rabbi's student said that I'll remember that if he runs for chief rabbi or something. But as long as he's running for governor, it's irrelevant. And just three more things I want to add that relates to previous classes, and then we'll begin. A number of you sent me information on the circumcision or supposed circumcision of the British royal family. Supposedly, Charles, King Charles, was circumcised by the Mole Jacob Snowman. You can look him up. And but the notion, there's even been two academic articles on this. Where does the idea come from that since Queen Victoria, all the British males have been circumcised by Moleim? That appears to be just a legend. And but worth, you can see the whole Wikipedia article on Jacob Snowman. Again, it's not ancient history. The king is alive. We could actually determine this. Chief Rabbi Mervis is spending Shabbos. I think it's this Shabbos, right? Before the
in May.
They don't call it
May.
Inauguration. May. Coronation.
Yeah. Yeah. They just announced that when it's in May, Mark.
Oh, it's in May. So the coronation.
They announced
in May?
It now that when they have the coronation, he'll spend Shabbos there.
So I know it's maybe weird. You don't ask for Jews. It's to ask a non-Jew, are you circumcised? It's not really the sort of thing you ask. But he could do it in a sort of interesting way that people have wondered about your connections to the Jewish community. I will note also that the coronation will be in a church and the chief rabbi will be in the church because the chief rabbis go to churches for all these sort of events. This takes us back to the very first class in the series, the second class in the series, the previous series. I made a mistake about Shaul Berlin. I said that he gave a haskama to Mendelssohn's Bior. Remember the Besamim Rosh? It's actually, and thank you for Yitzi to calling this to my attention. Yitzi wanted the source for it, and when I looked into it, it's reported that incorrectly in certain sources, but when I looked into it, it's actually his father, Ritzvi Hirsch Berlin. And the final thing I want to say is, I meant to say this a few classes ago, because I think you'll find it interesting. Right before Rosh Hashanah, I think I was going to say it, Yom Kippur, here's a rough form. If I were to tell you that, someone said that you shouldn't have kaparos, instead you should do it with money, and because of Tsar Balei Chaim, things like that, you'd think that this rabbi is non-Orthodox, you think he's progressive or, you know, open Orthodox, left-wing YU or something. However, Rabbi Mazuz, who those of us who've been with us know, in his weekly newsletter, number 328, you can check it out. He speaks out against kaparos. And what does he say? He says that some people say you shouldn't do kaparos with actual chickens because it's hard. The guy's going to shecht all these chickens, try and do it quickly. They might turn out treif. He says, I say for a different reason. Zet sar balei chayim. Lama osim et zeh? Bishvil ma? Ma yatzalna lanu mitzeh? So here you have someone not from the open Orthodox or anything also saying that to get rid of this kaparos, that that's really what Pita says, that Tsar Balei Chaim. And the position of the Aguda has always been that if you say it's Tsar Balei Chaim, you're anti-Orthodox. And here you have Rav Mazuz saying it's Tsar Balei Chaim. If you know what they do with these chickens, how they stack them up in the heat, and it is Tsar Balei Chaim. So you could check it out. He has other interesting things in this very issue. So, for instance, he quotes a certain rabbi. We spoke about Kiddush HaChodesh. He quotes a certain rabbi, doesn't mention his name, who says that our calendar is so perfect that when Mashiach comes, we're not going to go back to declaring the new moon with witnesses. We're going to keep it with the calendar. And Rabbi Mezuzah doesn't like that. He says, who says? How does he know? When Mashiach comes, you can ask him. But and he does point out something also really interesting, because in speaking about Kaparos, he says something most of you might know, that Shulchan Aruch is opposed to Kaparos. Shulchan Aruch calls it Darche Amori. There's a practice of the non-Jews. So there's an old, he doesn't say it, that he says in the first edition, the heading, Minhag Kaparos Minhag Shtus. He calls it a stupid minhag kaparos. And this is based on the fact that the Ramban and the Rashba and others were against kaparos. They saw it as like an idolatrous practice. So he doesn't go that far. He calls it minhag shtus. He doesn't want to insult people. But the Ramban and the Rashba and others, because think of what kaparos is. You transfer in your sins, all that. It's very weird, and it doesn't go in with our normal ways of understanding these matters. But there's been a lot of discussion going back hundreds of years already. Who wrote the headings? Because it's the heading that's problematic, where he says it's Minhag Shtus. And there were those who said that, I discussed this in Changing the Immutable, that the headings were written not by the Shulchan Aruch, and most people say, no, of course they're written by the Shulchan Aruch. It appeared during Rabbi Yosef Karo's lifetime. And we have plenty of people attesting that Rabbi Yosef Karo did, or at least claiming from around that time, that Rabbi Yosef Karo, it's his headings. And that's what I always assumed was the truth. But Rav Mazuz comes up with an unbelievable proof, which I never thought of, I didn't know, in which he claims that it's... that no, the headings are not by the Shulchan Aruch. What's the proof? If you look in Aruch Haim, Siman 291, the heading is the laws of the third meal. What does he call it? Din Shalosh Seudot. And then it's all about Yezayim Olda Kayim Mitzvah Seudah Shlishit. It's all about the final meal. And Rabbi Mazuz says as follows. What is this Shalosh Seudot? It should have said Seudah Shlishit. And Rav Mazuz says, we know that in Venice, in the printings, you had people working there also who were Ashkenazim. Venice and all Ashkenazi community. Rav Mazuz says, only Ashkenazim say Shalosh Seudot. We say Shalosh Seudot already. Sfardim have never said Shalosh Seudot. And it doesn't make sense. It's not Shalosh. It's Seudot. We say we're going to eat Shalosh Seudot. No, we're eating Seudah Shlishit, the final meal. And yet, if you look in the heading in the Shulchan Aruch, it uses the Ashkenazic way of referring to Seudah Shlishit, something which Sfardim have never done. So I have to say, this is an amazing proof that the headings, I think it reopens the question, were the headings written by Maran, Rav Yosef Karo, or were they written by the typesetter at the printing house in Venice? That's where it, as I recall, it first appears. But even if not in Venice, you had Italy had Ashkenazim. Of course, Italy had Ashkenazim. The Ashkenazim spoke Italian, and they sounded Italian, but they were Nusach Ashkenaz. So, okay, let us now begin our new series. We've had a number of series. Let's see, since COVID, we had the Mir Yeshiva, 4 classes. Then we had my latest book, 53 classes. We had Shaul Lieberman, 18 classes. We had the Rise of Reform, 23 classes. And now we're on, it won't be as long, but don't let anyone tell you we do things short and sweet. And Baruch Hashem, we have time to stretch it out. So we're going to look at it at another response. The response of Rav Zachariah Frankel, the so-called positive historical school, usually regarded as the precursor to conservative Judaism. In fact, if you open in the book The Chosen, Chaim Potok's book, JTS is referred to as Zachariah Frankel Seminary. That's The Chosen. If you haven't read the book, especially the young people who listen to us, I highly recommend it. They even made a movie about it. I'm sure you can still get the movie on Amazon or on one of the other sites. Chaim Potok, the book is, he went to the seminary, but he started at YU, and you have certain characters there. Saul Wojcik is presented, Rav Yochum Gorelick is presented, and then when he goes to the seminary, I guess Lieberman, Halivni, apparently, Halivni told me that the star of the father of the star is based on Halivni's life. That is, if you recall, the father of the kid who goes to there's two of them. There's Malter, and then there's a Chassidish guy who ends up going to YU. But the critical scholar who's presented there, the father of the other one, that's based on Halivni. That's what I was told by Halivni. And there's no one else at the seminary. It wasn't Lieberman. Lieberman was a traditional Torah scholar. I'm not going to give a complete biography of Frankl, otherwise we'd have, well, there's not there's anything wrong with it, but that's not what I want to do here, just like I didn't give a full biography of Geiger. I'm just going to speak about his biography as it's relevant to the feud or the rejection of reform, and some things are not really so much part of his biography as his intellectual biography. We will see that as well, his books, the dispute he had with Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, etc. Rav Zacharia Frankl, here, let me show you a picture of him. He has a very pious look. Here he is. His dates are 1801 to 1875. And as I mentioned, he's often regarded as the first conservative with a small c thinker. Although in his lifetime, many traditional rabbis regarded him as one of their own. In fact, as we shall see, some of his views that created such controversy, a whole polemic against him by Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, another rabbi named Gottlieb Fischer, what he said, I think most of you will find this not at all really radical or controversial. Things he said are routinely repeated by professors at Bar-Ilan University, at Bernard Revel Graduate School, and many others who associate with Orthodoxy. Rav Yechiel, although he was regarded as a complete outside the fold by Hirsch, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg treated him respectfully, even Israel Hildesheimer, who fought very strongly against him. After Frankl's death, he did refer to him as a blessed memory. Rav Yaakov Weinberg always refers to him as Rav Zachariah Frankl. He doesn't put him in the category of the Gedolim for all sorts of reasons. I mean, he was in the wrong camp, as it were, but much like Lieberman is given respect, Rabbi Weinberg always treats Frankl with respect. He has had a student, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, named Joseph Apfel, who was a rabbi in Leeds for many years, and he was a Dayan also. He wanted to translate Frankl's work, Darchei HaMishnah. I have a letter from Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg to Apfel advising him, don't translate it, because you'll then be attacked by the Hirschians, because they hate Frankl. And if you know English Jewry, there's a whole contingent of Hirschians in London, in particular, the Monk Shul. Rav Yosef Zacharia Stern, that amazing genius who one day will have classes on him, he also refers respectfully to Frankl. Since we have people from Toronto, including Rabbi Kelman, I'll say none other than Rav Gedalia Felder refers to Frankl as Rav Zacharia Frankl. There's others, Rav Nassim Adler, Chief Rabbi of England, and take a look at the introductions in the Synagogue, his commentary on Unkelus. He refers to him as Harav HaGadol Moreno Harav Zachariah Frankl. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Chayes refers to him as Harav HaGadol HaChacham HaKolel Moreno Rav Zachariah Frankl, and also HaGaon Frankl. So you see that in the Orthodox world, there isn't one position on Frankl. There's, just like we saw with Lieberman, you'll have people who refer very negatively to Lieberman, and you have others who refer to him with all the highfalutin titles. One of Frankl's students was Rav Dov or Bernard Ritter. He was the rabbi in Rotterdam, Holland. He went on to become one of the leaders of Agudas Yisrael and a leading spokesman in Western Europe of anti-Zionist orthodoxy. He always defended Frankl's reputation. He refers to him as a tzaddik. Let me show you something that'll blow you away now. I mentioned maybe it only could happen in Ishbitz. I don't know. But there is a sefer called Dor Yesharim. And this is all about the Yichus. It's a biography of all the different members of the dynasty of Ishbitz Radzin. It's a Hasidic dynasty. It goes back to, and that's what Leib Eger was part of. But it goes back to Reb Mordechai Yosef of Ishbitz. And then that comes the Radziner dynasty. Shaul Magid, in his first book, was devoted to the first Radziner Rebbe. The Ishbitz dynasty is had a great influence on Shlomo Karlbach. Is interesting for a variety of reasons. They're the ones in Ishbitz, or the Ishbitzer, who don't really believe in free will. I mean, we like to think that free will is basic to traditional Judaism, and normally it is, but in Ishbitz, they think for tzaddikim, they think that that God could remove your free will, and when many tzaddikim sin, it's because their free will has been removed from them from God, and they're supposed to sin. That's we need a whole class to get involved in this Ishbitz. It goes into Rav Tzadok as well. But take my word for it that the traditional view that everyone has free will, and just think what this means. You see a tzaddik sinning, you assume, well, he's not really sinning. God wants him to. That's, take a look in the Meshin Loach, especially Parshas Pinchas, what the Ishbitzer does with Zimri. We think Zimri is a big Rasha. No, for the Ishbitzer, Zimri is a big tzaddik, and it's Pinchas, who he calls a na'ar. He doesn't understand. Now, those who know about Shlomo Karlbach can see why this would be attractive, perhaps, to Shlomo Karlbach. Okay, so if you look in this sefer, it goes through all the different Rabbanim, and when it gets to Avram Heschel Leiner, that's the father of the Radziner Rebbe, Rabbi Yerucham Leiner, a big rav in America. First, he tells this story. This is not what I mentioned. I just want to contrast the two, that Rav Avram Heschel Leiner said that he once was in Chutzlaritz, that is, once outside of Poland, I guess in Germany, and lo and behold, he runs into Geiger, a reformator Ashkenazi Geiger, Uchashara Geiger. So when Geiger saw him, what did Geiger do? Barach milfanav hisrachek mimenu. I guess Geiger was afraid of the holiness of this Rebbe, Rav Avraham Yeshua Heschel. He was Avraham Yeshua Heschel Leiner. He was in Chelm, the city of Chelm. Okay, so now we know that what he says about Geiger, and he's a Chassidus Rebbe. If you turn a few pages later, now I know this, what I'm going to show you, because Tzvi Leshem of Israel pointed this out to me a number of years ago. You find the following thing, which is, it's incredible, really. He's talking about the Rebbe, and on page 90, let's see, what page is it? 93. Sorry, I have to go back here. If you look in the Sefer, page 93, it says as follows, right at the top, in discussing who the Rebbe's friend of this Rebbe from the Ishbitz dynasty, his friends were, third line, Gam im harav hagaon, hachacham hamamulad, hanoda l'shem utila, harav Zachariah Frankel Zal, mi Breslau, hayelo yedidut v'kesher ava rabba. So the Rebbe had a great and close connection to Rav Zachariah Frankel, and Rav Zachariah Zal praised him because he knew what a great person he was. So here you have a Hasidic text speaking of Rav Zachariah Frankel as with such such strong terms, how great what close friendship they had. So that's worth knowing. It's worth being aware of it, that and it's not just with Frankel. Even the seminary in Breslau that we'll speak about, which is called the Jewish Theological Seminary, it's not an accident that seminary in New York takes the name Jewish Theological Seminary, and it did have people like Gritz, who you can't really put him in the Orthodox camp. On the other hand, a number of rabbis came out of the Jewish Theological Seminary in Breslau who ended up serving in Orthodox communities. Americans should know the name Bernard Drachman. Bernard Drachman was one of the leaders of American Orthodoxy before American Orthodoxy was fashionable in the early part of the 20th century. I think he dies in 1940, I think. He was one of the founders and leaders of the OU. He's a Breslau graduate, and there's others as well. He attended after Frankel's death. Frankel was a man of unquestioned piety, and that's why the Orthodox, or many of the Orthodox, not the ones I mentioned, saw him as so dangerous. Because here you have someone who was unquestionably particular in all the commandments, as they say in the rabbinic expression, the very deep commandments. I mean, the significant ones, the ones that you know, violate Shabbos, that sort of thing, and also the so-called light ones. He was also the story goes, and I once told this story, and I said that it appears in one of Rav Shimon Schwab's works. And I was asked where, and I looked, and I can't find it. I found another passage where he refers to Frankel. So I can't remember where I saw this. I definitely saw it somewhere. I have to find it. Who said it? Maybe it was Schwab, but not in his collected writings. And the story is that Frankel was once together with a lot of the East European rabbis at one of these hotels they used to go to, resorts. And all the rabbis were carrying outside because there's an Erev, and Frankel was not carrying. And the story, as it was told, was to say, this shows how dangerous Frankel is, because he was Dafka frummer than the East European rabbis. But that's the reason why you need to be more afraid of him, because don't be taken in by the outer look of him, that he's very pious in terms of halacha, because his views are actually heretical. And you need to be aware, and don't look at the outside, look at the inside. So who was Frankel? Well, he's descended from a long line of rabbis. He was born and raised in Prague. He studied in the yeshiva of Rabbi Saul Ronsberg, one of the leading rabbis of Prague in the late 18th, early 19th century. He also studied in the university in Budapest. He was appointed later as the district rabbi, a district rabbi in Bohemia. He was the first actually district rabbi with a modern education in the city of Teplitz in Bohemia. And in 1836, he becomes rabbi of Dresden in Germany. And in 1854, he comes to Breslau to lead this new seminary, newly opened modern rabbinical seminary, really the first of its kind. It's the first rabbinical seminary before the Rabbino Seminar of the Orthodox and before the Reform Seminary. And this will become a place of outstanding scholarship, which JTS in New York modeled itself after in many ways. And there are many great scholars there. Heinrich Retz, the historian, was there. Israel Levy, the great Talmudist who succeeds Frankel, but other people who were identified with Orthodoxy. So, for instance, Ephraim Orbach studied there and taught there. Yitzhak Heinemann, the great Yitzhak Heinemann from Israel, was there as well. So you have, it's very much like the seminary in that you had people from the Orthodox camp who taught there and even went there. And as I said, its graduates served Orthodox communities sometimes, just like JTS graduates in the early part of the 20th century would also serve Orthodox communities. As we said, Louis Finkelstein himself served an Orthodox shul.
Also, Benno Yaakov. Shouldn't you mention Benno Yaakov?
Benno Yaakov, but yeah. he was not regarded as Orthodox ever, Benno Yaakov, to my knowledge. Now, Frankel was an enormous Talmud Chacham. Incidentally, I recently was told that none other than the great Rav Shlomo Fischer, who passed away last year, the Goner of Shlomo Fischer, was in awe of, I should say, very impressed with Zachariah Frankel's learning. I think it's fair to say that of the four great figures, rabbinic figures, or the three ones we'll speak about, Hirsch, Frankel, and Geiger, in terms of just Talmudic learning, Geiger is far and away the star of that group. Let me just show you some of his Sfarim that he wrote. The Archei HaMishnah. This is the one we're going to talk about. This creates all the controversy about the method of the Mishnah and other Sfarim. He wrote an introduction to the Yerushalmi, Mavo Yerushalmi. He wrote three volumes of a commentary on three Masechtos in Yerushalmi, Brachos, Peya, and Demai. Here is just a page of Brachos. So you can see here the... He has his Rashi and his Tosfos. And this is a very important work if you do Yerushalmi. I pointed out something, and I didn't notice this. Someone else noticed it, but I gave him the credit in Sol Libra and the Orthodox. Adin Steinsaltz, after he finished with the Bavli, he started with Yerushalmi. I don't know how many Masechtas he finished Yerushalmi. Maybe someone could answer. I think the first tractate he did, if I'm not mistaken, was Peah. I don't know how many he got.
I think he only did Peah. I don't
only
think he
Peah?
Went beyond.
Okay. Art Scroll has done, I don't know if Art Scroll has finished Yerushalmi now, but they've done many, many volumes. But if you look in Rabbi Steinsaltz's edition of Peah, the Yerushalmi, throughout the Gemara there, you have explanations that are given, like he has on the Steinsaltz stuff, you have at the bottom there, you have Iyunim, where he gets into more detail some of the issues, and then he has Halacha. So in the Iyunim, if you look in the Bavli, so example, he'll quote Tosfos, Rashba, Pnei Yeshua, and in Yerushalmi, he'll quote the Yerushalmi commentators, Ridbaz, Pnei Moshe, whatever the new commentators are. And he also quotes Zion apostrophe Pei. What is Zion apostrophe Pei? You have to go to the back. In the back, that's where he tells you all the abbreviations. Like if he quotes Ridbaz, who's the Ridbaz? Look in the back. There's nothing in the back. So this was Steinsaltz's way of getting in Zion Pei as a Zacharia Frankel. He doesn't call him Reish Zion Pei, which is what usually people who quote him call him. He just calls him Zion Pei, and he doesn't tell you in the back who he is. So basically, Hamevin Yavin, those who know will know, and everyone else that just goes over their head. Frankel was a strong opponent of reform. As we shall see, he attends the conference in 1845 in Frankfurt we spoke about. But when he gets there and he sees the radical trends being advocated, he leaves it and publishes publicly why he left. And there was a few reasons, but fundamentally, when he saw that they were ready to jettison Hebrew, you know, the Hebrew was not important. It made clear to him that this was not a movement that he could be there. Now, it is true that Frankel did permit some changes. He departs from Orthodoxy. That is 19th century Orthodoxy. Whether this would mean 21st century Orthodoxy departs, that's my point, that some of the things that he did fit in very well with 21st century Orthodoxy, but not in. So, for example, while in Teplitz, he agrees to get rid of some piyutim. I don't think today, if you hear about a rabbi getting rid of piyutim, we've all gotten rid of it, that would be, but in Germany, you know, this was the old German minhag to recite these piyutim. You had to say that. And it's one thing that it fell away in Russian Poland, but to actually declare, you know, in Ashkenaz, these are Ashkenazic piyutim, that was considered over the line. But he did it. He got rid of them. As I said, I've said it many times in all our shows I've seen it in my lifetime. When I was young on Tisha B'Av, we sat there for hours reading kinos that none of us understood. Now, in all the shows I've been to, they get rid of most of them. They pick a few kinos, you say them, and then the rabbi talks about them and explains them. And there's a rabbinic expression, better a few with kavana than a lot without kavana. But I have to tell you, he did. He was Orthodoxy looked upon him negatively because he got rid of piyutim. He also instituted a choir in his shul of young men. This is, later Hirsch also brings a choir in, but he was before Hirsch. He performs weddings in the synagogue. Weddings in the synagogue, when we get to Hungary, you'll hear all about weddings in the synagogue, but it's not only in Hungary. In Germany, it's also a problem. This is not something that the Orthodox did. Hirsch would do this. And he made it kosher, I guess. And he wasn't the only one in Germany who did it, but it was considered problematic for many to do weddings in the synagogue. Frankel saw himself between the traditionalism of the old school and the orthodoxy of Hirsch on one side, because he is not an adherent of Hirschian style orthodoxy. We'll see this. Not for halachic reasons. The halacha of Frankel is the same halacha of Hirsch. And in some areas, Frankel could be made more stringent. Not in some areas, Hirsch could be more stringent. That's not the issue. There's going to be a fundamental theological dispute between Hirsch and Frankel. whether the listeners think that there needed to be such a dispute, and whether Orthodoxy Today would have this issue. That's something we're going to get into soon, but it was not a matter of halakha, like with Geiger, when obviously halakha's dogma is also central, but halakha, you don't need to even go to dogma when it could deal with the reform. So Frankl sees himself on the one hand between old style orthodoxy or traditionalism and new style orthodoxy of Hirsch on the one hand and reform on the other. Just to give you an example, during the controversy over the Hamburg prayer book, Frankl rejects the sitter as an invalid sitter for the reasons we saw. It gets rid of any hope for redemption. It all sorts of halakhic problems with this sitter. On the other hand, Frankl says, just because the reformers have gone overboard and done terrible things doesn't mean that we can't make changes in the sitter. And he's not just referring to the second Yikum Borkan from last week, that there are some, we can make changes. Changes can be made. That his attitude was that who said the sitter is locked in stone? And by the way, it's for the Orthodox, the sitter is locked in stone precisely because the reform are trying to change it. That becomes a theme, as we know, in Orthodoxy, that when the reformers are trying to make changes, we need to chadash asur min haTorah. The Chasam Sofer makes it very clear. Now we can't change anything because we're in this battle. Frankl refused to go along with this. So he agreed that we still can make changes and we should investigate what sort of changes can be made, because there are aspects of the Seder which maybe today are really not appealing to people. We can come up with new prayers, whatever it was. He breaks with orthodoxy because he says that I do not accept the fact that the sitter cannot be changed. And just because reform is doing it doesn't mean that we can't do it. That is reforms with a small r. Now, Hirsch doesn't attack him for this. Others will attack him for this. Hirsch's response is going to be very different, because Hirsch himself, we did classes on Hirsch, the third and fourth, I think it's third, fourth, and fifth classes, or maybe the second and third and fourth classes I ever did were on Hirsch when we first began this series, or maybe it was the first, second, and third classes. I can't remember now. When Rabbi Kelman had the idea before anyone else to have these online, E-team they called it in those days, the first Torah classes in the world given live. It was just like we have now, a system you could see and you could type your questions in. Before Zoom, but it was a system. He was the first one to do it by about 6 months or a year. No one else was doing it. And first classes I ever did on Hirsch. But if we probably should do Hirsch again, and we'll get to some of Hirsch when we deal with the dispute between him and Bamberger. But Hirsch also believed in reforms with a small r. Hirsch gave sermons in the vernacular. Hirsch had choirs. Hirsch did weddings in the synagogue. He even brought he made sure the women stayed up in the gallery, but the mother of the bride was allowed to come into the synagogue. And that was regarded as a reform. And Frankl also, now what did Frankl call his form of Judaism? It's not orthodoxy. It's not reform. He called it, quote, positive historical Judaism. Now that's a mouthful. Can you imagine today, you know, we have the different denominations saying, I'm positive historical. But that's what he called it. So what did he mean by the term positive historical? He used this term first when he leaves the Frankfurt Conference and rejects it. He says that this is not our Judaism, this Reform Judaism. Our Judaism is positive historical Judaism. Well, for one, positive is the opposite of negative. The Reform is just negative. It's all about, in his mind, it's all about destroying Judaism, so it's negative. Remember, the reform for his story, we're not interested in building up, they're only interested in cutting down. It was all what we can get rid of. And so therefore, we don't want that. We don't want to destroy Jewish tradition. Shorsch, however, Ismar Shorsch, the former chancellor of the seminary, chancellor for a number of years, he's an expert. He comes from Germany, and his area of scholarly interest is German Jewish history. And he just recently came out with a book on Sunz. But he also was a great admirer of Frankl, and he wrote an article on Frankl. Shorsch is really the last of the chancellors of the seminary holding on to the old, what he thought was the old way, although some would say everyone after Gerson Cohen, it's not the old way, but at the final graduation, I think it was, people can correct me, I think it was the final graduation, Schorsch gives a talk in which reflecting very poorly on the direction he sees the seminary going. But Schorsch is really tied very much to this old Frankelian approach to what really positive historical Judaism. So Schorsch in his article shows that the term positive also is not just a shorthand, it also has a legal context, because Hegel wrote an essay called, quote, "The Positivity of the Christian Religion." So Hegel uses it, he attacks Christianity for preserving, against Jesus's intent, the attachment to the law. So Hegel's against that. Now, for Frankl, the word positive describes his conception of Judaism, that yes, it is a positive legal character, and that's a good thing, that Judaism is basically a legalistic religion. Christianity couldn't handle this. They didn't like legalisms. But as I said, not only Hegel, it's the old joke that they got rid of 613 commandments, and at least the Catholic Church added 1,000 more, because it became a very legalistic religion, at least Catholicism did. But for Frankl, Judaism is fundamentally a legalistic religion, and Jewish values, Jewish ideas are expressed in the law. It's actually very similar to Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik, his whole idea of halachic, he was going to write, they say this is halachic mind, but he was going to write a whole philosophy of Judaism through the halacha, that halacha is where you see it all. Someone once asked me, and he asked me, a rabbi, he said, and I thought it was very insightful. He said that, you know, all these people, they give classes on Jewish ethics. He says, do we really have Jewish ethics? Don't we just have halacha? And halacha encompasses all sorts of things. It encompasses ethics, and encompasses. So it's something interesting to think about. I would look at it the other way. I would say Jewish law encompasses everything, so you don't have to just speak in terms of the law. Ethics, yes, they're part of the law, but they also have an ethos. According to Frankl, the sages, Chazal, were able to ensure that Jewish law is not frozen, fossilized. How do they do that? Anyone who studied Talmud, you know, through their drashot, through their the law is a living law. So here also you have themes that are going to pop up in conservative Judaism in the 20th century, but not just conservative Judaism. Eliezer Berkowitz, Emanuel Rachman, other modern Orthodox figures, everyone who wants to fight against the fossilization. Always the people to your right, like we spoke about earlier, everyone wants to claim the mantle of the Pharisees. Frankl's point is that, yes, we believe in Jewish law, but what is Jewish law fundamentally? It moves. It's not fossilized. It only became rigid when there was an exile, when Jews were forced into exile, and therefore the oral law had to be codified. So therefore we have codification. So this means that after the period of the Mishnah and the Talmud, the freedom of the law to develop organically and through the guidance of the sages really ended to a large extent. And from Frankl's perspective, the challenge for us is to try to regain this ability for Jewish law to have vitality, to move. Now, what I just said could be seen as code word for conservative Judaism, for heretical Judaism, for changing Jewish law, or it can be seen as a way of trying to make Jewish law as a living law, something that's not in opposition to tradition, but in opposition to fossilization, that is deciding Jewish law as if it was 200 years ago. So that's why Frankl is such an ambiguous figure, because you could be the most orthodox person and speak about how Jewish law has to be contemporary, how the post-scheme have to understand what's going on in the world, and that they can't decide Jewish law today as if they're 200 years ago. They need to know the Metzius. Emanuel Rachman writes an essay in Judaism in the 1960s describing Rav Moshe Feinstein as an advocate, or a practitioner, I should say, of this very form of halacha, a halacha that is with the times and doesn't stand still, and Posek recognizes the reality out there. Now, Ramosha might disagree with this characterization, but that was Rackman's point, that when you look at what Ramosha was doing in Evan HaEzer, that he wasn't just relying on what people said in earlier years. He was being Mechadesh. He was coming up with new ideas. He was doing what great rabbis have always done in the days that we can't do make drashot. So how are we original today? We're original through insights, through new readings of the Talmud. So you see that you can read Frankel in more than one way. Wait till we're going to see this in more detail. Frankel, therefore, was willing to alter certain practices, halachic practices, which be at odds, I guess you would say, with the Orthodox. So, for instance, he was prepared to allow autopsies under certain circumstances. Now, this is something that, as an Orthodox rabbi, you could also argue for. We've had people, Rabbi Fiakov Weinberg, argues for autopsies at medical school in Israel. But the Noda Yehuda said that autopsies are only permitted if you have an issue, let's say, of a disease, then the dead person, the person is, you're going to do an autopsy for someone right here, which is going to help someone that's right in front of you. Well, in the 20th century, you had a number of Orthodox figures, not major ones, but others who said that today the mace is always, that is, the disease is always in front of you, because they could do an autopsy and discover something in China today that tomorrow we could apply. So if you want to make halachic argument for autopsies, you can make it. But that's what he said. He argued for autopsies. It was going against the grain. It was not halachic. You know, to make that argument, you sort of need to be a posek. He's not a posek. He's a scholar. So by saying this, he's really putting himself outside of orthodoxy. He also agreed to delay burial. We saw this great dispute between Mendelssohn and Rebecca Venden. You can make all the halachic arguments in the world for it, that now we know that we think that some people are dead. They might not really be dead, but that's not how the poskim decided it. So if in the 19th century, if the Chasam Sofer were to come and say delay burial, we'd say, well, this is a psak of the Chasam Sofer. That's obviously, it's in the fold because he's the Chasam Sofer. But when Frankel comes and agrees with Mendelssohn and says that in some cases we need to delay burial, that ipso facto is placing him outside of orthodoxy. I'm not saying outside of halacha necessarily, but because he would argue halachically, but it's definitely not orthodox. And really, it's not, you could say it's not even halachic, because traditionally halachic Jews have to follow what the great poskim say. Frankel is consciously saying, I am going against these poskim because I think the poskim are wrong on this matter. So that's not orthodox, and whether it's halachic or not, we can debate. And he was prepared to study the possibility, that is, not that rabbis, he thought that this is something we could get together and study, that in theory, we could get rid of Yom Tov Sheni. He didn't get rid of Yom Tov Sheni, but he said if the rabbis have the authority, if they would come together and conclude that, then we could. They didn't come, so he didn't get rid of it. But he thought that if I were to tell you how many Israeli liberal Orthodox rabbis said when the state of Israel was declared, not just in Israel, in America too, now we can get rid of Yom Tov Sheni. Lots of them said that. But that's what Frankel said. So is this enough to push him out of tradition? Maybe yes, maybe no. He called what he wanted to do moderate reform, that is, reform with a small r. And he said, but the only way halacha can be changed is in a way that's authentic to the system. So there already we've seen how he breaks, how he departs from traditional Judaism. We're going to get into this in more detail. He also did not think that halacha was all there is to it. Now, some of these things I'm saying, it's going to show you how he has a different way of thinking than the traditional Orthodox halachic authorities. That is, yes, there's halacha. So when you decide halacha and you want to know what direction to go, you have to open up the sources, the Gemaras, the Rambam. Believe me, he knew the Gemara, the Rambam, as well as anyone in his day. But he also pointed to history. And this is where we're going to get to his real uniqueness and significance. And that's why he calls it positive historical. So, for instance, Hebrew. We went into great detail in a few classes. What's the problem with davening in English or German? German, that was the issue in Germany. You have explicit Gemara, you have explicit Rambam. The undeniable halacha says to feel a b'chol Hashem. So we saw what the halakha authorities, they knew where this was going to lead, and they had to come up with all sorts of reasons to say it's forbidden. Frankel comes at it from a completely different perspective. He doesn't come up with halakha, quasi-halachic justifications. He says Judaism is not only halachic. This is Heschel's great criticism of Orthodoxy, calls it pan-halachism, that everything is halacha. Frankel says there's also history. And he's willing to acknowledge that 100%, according to halacha, you could change, you could daven in German. However, Judaism is not only about halacha, it's about history. We've all davened in Hebrew for thousands of years. That has a veto over halacha. The fact that you can argue halachically that you can make a justification for davening, you can daven in another language, that doesn't change the fact that history can veto halacha because we've never done that. And that'll destroy traditional Judaism. And therefore, this was the argument. I remember I said that the opposition to women rabbis should have really adopted the Frankelian argument. And some did. The ones who argued Masorah did, but many of them tried to argue halachically. They tried to come up with all sorts of reasons why you can't have women rabbis based on halacha. And one by one, the arguments, they don't stand up. If that makes me a conservative or an open, or I don't know what it makes me. I'm telling you, the arguments don't stand up because the same arguments saying about the women rabbis mean that you can't have a woman community scholar. There's no such thing as a halachic that you can have a woman community scholar giving to Torah, but if you give her a title, then all of a sudden there's no such thing as clergy. I mean, you can't say the halacha says you can't have woman clergy, but you can have women scholars, a women scholar in residence. That word is an American modern word. So this argument was doomed from the start, halacha. But the argument, if you want to argue that, I said the best way to argue is history. And that really was the argument of Soloveitchik in many areas, and that was the argument really coming out of not everyone, but some of YU, was Masorah. Now, a lot of people didn't like that argument. They rejected it. But at the end of the day, the argument from Masorah is the Frankelian argument. It's not only the Frankelian argument. We see Masorah in Orthodox texts also. But it's a more honest argument from history, because there's a lot of things that the Discipler says this. I quote the Discipler in one of my blog posts where he says that in some matters we don't go to halacha. Because we know from, he doesn't use the word history, he says he uses the word also Masorah. He goes, that's just, we know that this is the Jewish practice. So you don't even go to try to argue it. So that's what Frankel said, that some of these arguments should not be argued halachically because they're historical. And the weight of history, and for the similarly, you had some of these reform leaders, we know that they were enamored with the Sephardic world. Another article by Shorsh, The Myth of Sephardic Supremacy. We spoke about how they wanted to change, they changed the pronunciation to Sephardic pronunciation. Think about the stupidity of this, the craziness of this, that Ashkenazi Jews are going to change their pronunciation, not because it's the state of Israel and that's the language I speak there, just because they think it's a pure thing. And Frankel's, not only that, then they wanted to do piyutim, like on high holidays, the reformers said, let's do Sephardic piyutim. Because they're more grammatical, because they can come up with all the reasons that the Kalir Piyutim were there. They have all these problems. What Frankel said is that the history of Ashkenazic Jewry was obviously, it's Ashkenazic, so you have to speak Ashkenazic, but it was sanctified by martyrdom. It has great significance. These Piyutim are the Piyutim of our great scholars, the Ashkenazic scholars. History has obligated us to this Ashkenazic tradition. So it's not about an argument halachically, can you change the piyutim to Sephardic? Of course you can change it to Sephardic. Halachically, can you change the pronunciation? Okay, that's a halachic debate. But Frankel says you don't go into the debates over these matters because history has a vote and a veto. The reform argument always was that history has a vote, not a veto. So basically, yeah, you look at history, but if we don't like history, we don't need to follow it because it doesn't have a veto. Frankel says not only does history have a vote, history has a veto, and the veto is more powerful than halacha, because halacha cannot tell you that you can't substitute Sephardic piyutim for Ashkenazim, but history can tell you that you can't do that. Okay, so far so good. Franco seems maybe a little bit on the edge, but nothing really outside of the fold. So why such a controversy? Why is he an apikoros for not just Rosh Hashanah or Hirsch, but many others? And why did other gedolim think that he's okay? And what was the big what creates all the controversy? And so we're going to get into this in more detail. We'll see. I don't need to anticipate. We're going to get there. We've, as I've said many times, I think I say it almost every time we begin a new class, as the song says, we've only just begun. But I promise you, Rabbi Kelman, we're not doing 20 classes. That I know, because I'm very excited to get on to the Hirsch Bamberger dispute.
Okay, you don't have to apologize. I fall down for the restrictions, you know.
I know. I'm joking. I'm kidding with you. Because you're always telling me that I'm going to be more. So I don't know. But we shall see.
Experience has taught me that.
Wait till you see next week how Rav Kook sounds Frankelian, believe it or not. Okay. Let's get to some of the comments here. Shmuel says, my understanding that was Rav Shmuel Eder was adamantly opposed to Chazirus. Yes, he was. I was... when I said before that he was not into Hasidus, I didn't want to respond too harshly to the one who made the comment last time. But yes, he remains a very strong Misnagid, and it's his son, Rav Leibel Eger, that now you said it's commonly said Machasim Rav Shlomo Sat Shiva. I don't know if he sat Shiva, but it was a very, very big controversy, not kind of a very big problem between them. Someone privately texts me that the main motivation for kaparas with chickens is based on the practice of the Ari, like many other things. And the person who sent this has written much about these matters. I understand it's the minhag now, in many circles do with chickens, but even if it is your minhag, there's reasons not to do it. Rav Mazu says, if you privately, he says, like they used to do when he was a kid, if your father does it and then brings it to the shochet and shechs it, and then you eat it or you give it to a poor person, then what's the problem? There's no problem with kaparos, leaving aside the issues that it's nichosh or anything like that. But today, that's not what they do. It. They bring in cases and cases of chicken, and the chickens are in the hot sun. And many of these chickens, the poor people don't want. They'd rather have money anyway. So what do they want a chicken for? So today's day and age, the only reason to do it is nostalgia or just a minhag. So Mazuz's point is that the problem with this minhag is it's creating tsar ba'al chayim. If you don't believe me, take a look at videos. You can Google it. You see every year they would the reporters would go down to Williamsburg and Borough Park and because the pizza people would come to protest and that kaparos was never done like this in history, where they bring in cases of chickens just stacked in the hot sun outside. It just and not to mention the shlita issues, because the chicken has to, the shochet has to shecht again and again and again, and who says he's being reliable? And yes, I do need to say that someone reminds me Morris Feierstein, his first book, which was reprinted a second time, I don't know if it's still in print, is on Rav Mordechai Yosef of Ishbitz. And you can see in that book all about, not just about the Ishbitzer's idea that although the Mishnah says, Hakol b'dei shamayim chutz mi'yirat shamayim, that if you look more carefully, that even Yirat Shamayim is controlled by God, you can get an intellectual analysis of the Ishbitzer, the first of the Rado Chassidic Rebbe. So I recommend Dr. Feierstein's book on Ishbitz. And then I said you can get, if you want to move it to the next generation, Radzin, including dealing with the tzitzis, Shaul Magid's book. And Magid also wrote a book on the son of an article, as I recall, on the son of the Radziner. I think Rav Yaakov Liner was his name. Martin says he just found The Chosen, the whole movie on YouTube. Oshkoyach. Thank you for that. Although I have to say, as is always the case, I recommend first reading the book then you see the movie. I just had this experience. The first time I read this book, many of you I know have read it. If you hadn't, I recommend it. My children recommend it to me. I read it over the little break, the circus break, The Kite Runner. I had never read it. And what a book The Kite Runner is. It's one of the only books I've ever read, probably, maybe the only one I actually cried, literally, had tears, I should say, in the book. And then I watched the movie, because they also made a movie. There's even a play now in New York. And I guess the movie's okay, but when you read the book, you get so much more. I think someone texts me and said I meant to say that Frankel was the biggest Talmud Chacham, not Geiger. If I said Geiger was the biggest Talmud Chacham, I take that back. Frankel. If you compare the three big ones, Frankel, Geiger, and Hirsch, in my opinion, for what it's worth, but really Shlomo Fischer and others, that Frankel is really the greatest Talmudist. Hirsch's efforts, although he's a great Talmudist also, is not in Talmud. It's in other areas. And Geiger, he's also a great Talmudist, but his efforts is in other areas. Frankel really devotes his entire life to not just Talmud, Halakh, Midrash. Basically, he's learning day in and day out. He's not writing commentaries on Chumash. He's not writing philosophical, quasi-philosophical works like Hirsch is writing. He's just learning. Rabbi Shudnow says that Chief Rabbi of Great Britain, Joseph Hirsch, was the first graduate of the JTS. Yes, indeed he was. Everyone acknowledges, though, that in those days, the seminary, this was during the reign, I should say, of Sabato Mireyas. Everyone acknowledges that it was an Orthodox institution then, a modern Orthodox institution. The issue is when Solomon Schachter comes to town, then it moves into what you call the conservative camp. The question is, what about the seminary in Breslau, which we'll see. Suzanne asked, where do they do the weddings? You do the weddings outside, in the courtyard. Synagogues had courtyards. Are you doing people's houses? People who do weddings in their houses. Now, in medieval times, Jews did do weddings in the synagogue. Then it went out of fashion. There was this notion that you should do it outside, under the stars. Chuppah should be under the stars. And then the Reform put it back into the synagogues because they thought it was more dignified. And they were influenced also by the churches. This is where you have a wedding. So since they're doing it, since the Reform were doing it for the Orthodox then to do it, you can't do it. And we'll see when we get to the Hungarians. The Hungarians make a decree that you're not allowed to. And I forget now with Hildesheimer if he agrees with this decree, because Hildesheimer agrees with some of the decrees. But in Hungarian Orthodox synagogues, you were not allowed to have weddings in the synagogue. If you go to the Kaczynski Shul today, you'll see right in the back of it, there's a place to do chuppahs. Okay. Morris Feierstein, who I hope he'll answer the question later. Is his book still available in print? Because I know it was reprinted. He answers that the chuppah, as I said, was outside in the courtyard of the synagogue. Thank you. And Rabbi Shudnow says that Chancellor Shorsch was his teacher, and he criticized the RA and its new chumash. I will mention also that one of our listeners for a long time here is Rabbi Yaakov Yellen. He just came out with a book. On you can get it on Amazon. I just bought it on Amazon also for my university library on really Jewish law in the business world, like a standard of ethics, of law, based on Jewish insights for companies, big companies, and how you're supposed to run. Because every day you'll come up with issues, and he has a section in his book on ethics. And I recall in the book, the question is ethics in halacha? Is it beyond halacha? Var Lichtenstein's famous article, etc.
Thank you.
And Susanna says that sounds like the objections were political rather than substantive. Well, so far what we've seen, partly correct. We're going to see a very substantive thing, a dogmatic thing even. But even what we've seen so far, I mean, in the early 19th century, the first, let's say, third decade of the 19th century, to say that you could make changes in the Siddur, which is against what all the Gedolim have said, that's not just political. From an Orthodox perspective, that's also that's really determinative of which community you're in and could be seen really as a halachic matter, because traditional Jews, like I could always come up with an idea. It's okay for me to come up with a theoretical idea, but the notion is that to institute it practically, there has to be halachic authorities of stature who agree with it. Frankel was prepared to, he'd be prepared to take out piyuti, make changes, even without the imprimatur of great poskim. Now, he thought of himself as enough of a posek that he could do that, but that's already, I wouldn't call that political, at least I wouldn't call it. I understand that others would call it political, but I wouldn't. Yes, Ruth, it's tradition. Rabbi Kalman says, Achov Beit Tzion in Jerusalem, my son tells me they now say modern slichot that one can understand. And Rav Yoel Ben Nun has a new ketubah, which only recently did I see this ketubah. I took a picture, but I never heard of it. What can I say, Rabbi Kalman? I'm not being disrespectful to Rav Yoel Ben Nun if I say this, but if Rav Yoel Ben Nun was living at the same time as Frankel, Hirsch would have attacked him also. And he would have been expelled. And it's today. And if you had gone back 50 years ago when you would have done that, what would happen with Shaul Lieberman and his ketubah? Today we're so scattered now that in the Haredi world, they never heard of Rav Ben Nun. They don't care about him. So you could do these things, especially in Israel. You do it. In America, you can't. In America, if an American member of the RCA tried to come with a new ketubah, someone in the RCA would attack and it would be a controversy. In Israel, though, you don't have like right wing like that. If you're in the community of Yoel Ben Nun, that's also an enclosed community. You don't have these issues. You don't have to look over your shoulder. So you could do things like that. They could appoint a woman rabbi in a shul and they don't have to worry because they're their own communities. But a lot of this is the time. If you take, let me give you an example. I've given this example before. I've never published this because last week I said I gave the stuff away anyway. This I'm not going to give away because one day I'll write an article. I found two poskim, one 19th century and one 18th century. I mentioned this before for the new people who say that according to halacha, you can count a woman in a minyan, in theory at least, because it wasn't practical. Women are not going to shul in Eastern Europe, but they make an argument according to the Ramban's understanding. So they have a whole argument here, that was so irrelevant to the reality of the world as like the frozen etrogs or something like that. It was a whole theoretical discussion. According to the Ramban, can you count a woman? And yes, they conclude that according to the Ramban, you can count a woman to a minyan because it's all derabanan. And why we assume Chazal would make the same requirement. But there wasn't such a concept of any woman saying, well, we want to have a minyan to be counted. But if you would have made that same argument in the mid-20th century, by even maybe today, by definition, you'd be regarded as non-Orthodox, no matter how. Well, I told this to Professor Tursky once, and he didn't think it was such a big deal. He says, of course. He says, everything depends on the time. He says, time determines where you place, whether an idea is radical, he told me, is often only because of the time it's in. I actually told Professor Tversky about these chuvot I found because I thought they were so amazing. And he didn't think it was his attitude was basically you could find all sorts of stuff that in one generation don't raise an eyebrow, in another generation are very radical. Frankel's rabbinical training and influences, his rabbinical training is all traditional. But his influence is the university study. This was always the issue. What do you do with university study? It influences everyone. It influences Hildesheim, or it influences Rav Zvi Hoffman. The difference is Frankel was willing to use some his knowledge of history to then practically. So now we know, for instance, where the piyutim came from. We're going to get the big issue is going to be Halacha Moshe Mitzrayim. That's where his historical training comes into play. But he had there's no rabbinical training. Everything is traditional. And for that matter, the Reform rabbis, for the most part, the first generation all had traditional training. But yes, so Roy Kelman says that the first two of the 195 classes I gave were on Hirsch. Very nice. Okay, really that brings us to the end here. As I said, we're just beginning. Rabbi Kelman, I thank you all. Those who are here new with us, you see how it works, but we made it a new topic so we could advertise and new people come on. But we're really going strong now, a couple hundred, really. It's one long stream of consciousness, so we'll continue. Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you very much. By the way, just last week, as I'm teaching now, or talking earlier, at Chatting Contemporary Halakha, we're doing woman and ritual, the whole issue. So I was just recently looking up for years why a woman can't get conscience towards a minion. And as I'm researching, I say, you know, there's not such a good reason why we can't count women towards a minion.
Well, the reason is the Shohar said you can't. The Shohar said
you can't. There's no clear halachic, like, it's not so pashut. Like, you can, it's like what you say, like, it's not like, oh my God, like, there's a, you know, an absolute, like, the limud from a pasuk in black and white. It's not like that. It's, of course, it was never done. But so when you just mentioned, right, it's not, I'm not shocked that there were rabbanim who said.
Well, Rav Yoel ben Nun actually, he accepts, I don't know practically, but he said the conservative argument that a woman could accept upon herself mitzvah to say she's mangrama.
Yeah, I don't know if Yoel ben Nun says that. I heard that from, what's his name, Zohar, the one from Bar Ilan, I think. He said that if a woman accepts, obligates upon herself, mitzvah to say she's mangrama, she can be motzi a man, let's say, in shofar.
No, I think Yoel ben Nun, I'm not, I don't know if it's practical halacha maisa, but I think he puts forth that in theory, he thought this is an approach. I'll get the details for next week.
They had that, I remember years and years ago, at the first Jofa conference. Remember those in those days? So they had a whole plan. I wasn't there, but I listened on the tape later. They had a whole thing on that. And he said, it's a radical opinion that if a woman accepts mitzvah to say she's mangrama, like a man, so she's mechayiv herself. When she's mechayiv herself, she's on the same level as a man, and she can therefore be motzi the man for the mitzvah. Nunu, I'm just saying, like you say, it depends on the time. Rav Yoel ben Nun,
David Golinkin has an article in one of his volumes, a long article trying to make the case that women could be in a counted for a minion. The problem is, and you see where he breaks with orthodoxy, is you have to then treat the Shulchan Aruch as just another source that, let's say, Acharon or late Rishon, whatever, in which you say, well, we're not going to accept it. The problem is, for, I would say, to Glinken, is that the Shulchan Aruch is not just another source. The Shulchan Aruch has become the binding source. So you could say that if you accept upon yourself the mitzvahs, well, then the Shulchan Aruch's ruling doesn't apply to you. But that's all Glinken's saying. The Shulchan Aruch is binding. So what these rabbis were arguing was that according to the Ramban, you can count women for a minion. So it was never practical anyway, because the Shulchan Aruch is still binding. But maybe in a Shas HaTachak you could say, because look, if you can count one, if there is an opinion, Rabbeinu Simcha, he's quoted in the Mordechai, Simcha Vitri, he says you can count one woman to a minion. You look in the Mordechai, it's in Brachos in the back there, the Mordechai. He holds you can count one woman to a minion, which most people don't know about. But that's for the same reason you can count a katan for a minion. He says you can count one woman. But halacha l'maisa, I mean, the Shulchan Aruch says so. You really can't get rid of the Shulchan Aruch. In orthodoxy, you can't. Right. In conservative, you can.
The question is, I'm just, you know, just thinking, like you say, a stream of consciousness. Maybe with the return to Israel, maybe 50 years from now, it'll be different. You know, like you say, all this stuff is happening in Israel. And, you know, people, I know I'm not saying it, it's for sure not orthodox to say this, but maybe 50 years from now, they'll sort of be in a sense, you know, maybe we need a new Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, even though it was written in Sfat, but it was written.
That was the idea at the beginning. They said that, look, there have been times we don't follow the Shulchan Aruch. Correct. They think there's a Shas HaTachak. So in theory, a rabbi could argue that today with the change of women where they go to shul and we need to keep them connected, this is a Shas HaTachak and we can rely on the Ramban based on two sources I found. So anything's possible in theory, but generally we assume we go by the Shulchan Aruch and I don't see it happening. But look, anyone can make the argument. The question is, will it be accepted and will it be regarded as legitimate? And unless it's a posek of standing, at least in my opinion.
But as you know, a lot of things my Amadvar, just go see what the people do. And when you say Yoel ben Nun, it's according to never heard of him, right? But there's a whole community of people. I mean, he's in Yeshivat Har Etzion. He's not some fringe person.
I know. Listen, if I ever thought synagogues, if you told me 30 years ago a synagogue calling himself Orthodox would call women up for aliyahs, I would have said you're crazy. It never could happen. As historians, we know that the most dangerous thing is to predict the future. We like to stick to the past.
Right. Very good. Take it away. And Dr. Mel points out, yes, that's right. We are now in the process of putting Dr. Shapiro's talks on podcast, and people are listening. They're being posted sort of one by one. So we're actually expanding our our podcast things. This is a little bit beyond my my tech expertise, but we have people in the Torrent Motion team working on this kind of stuff for us. So to have more avenues for people to engage with the wonderful Torah we have and our wonderful teachers and speakers. So thank you. Tomorrow we have two wonderful speakers and teachers. That is at 11 a.m. Dr. Nava Finkelman will give her second part of her series on the treatment of foreigners, if the foreigner, the outsider. And then at 1 p.m., Rabbi Shulman, I have a fascinating class I was listening afterwards on Sefer Daniel, a book I imagine not too many of us have studied in depth, and going through Sefer Daniel. That will be at 1 p.m. Of course, we're six. I don't think anybody's on from Israel now, except maybe Mr. Eisen. I don't see him. But we're only 6 hours ahead. Of course, this week, people in Israel, so that'll be at 5 and 7. Israeli time. This week's Parsha Shir will be given by Rabbi Gedalia Berger. And then Wednesday, we have our two Shirim and Friday and all our regular classes. So we look forward to learning with you. Like I say, please invite a friend. And okay, everybody have a wonderful night. And let's hope we hear good things from Israel. Mark, where are you? I don't know if you're still here. I'm no talk about, you know, how the mixture of religion and politics that we have had now, we didn't used to have. That's a whole other topic, but I'm glad we don't talk about it. Okay, thank you very much. And Mr. I look forward to getting your thing. Hi, Rabbi Judno, nice to see you. And everybody, Laila Tov, and everybody be well. We should hear good things. I look forward to learning with you. Bye-bye.
Laila Tov.
Laila Tov.